once you see that, you say, now what do I do? The difference between Wilberforce and most of the people around him is that he prayed. And at some point, I think 2 years after this dramatic conversion, he writes in his diary what I say are 20 famous words. He writes, God Almighty has set before me two great objects. Number one, the suppression of the slave trade. And number two, what he called the reformation of manners. He meant the reformation of culture. In other words, he says, God Almighty has set before me. I didn't choose them. So if God chose me to take this on, it's not my battle. Just as you read in the Pentateuch, you know, the battle belongs to the Lord. You can't win this on your own. Once you realize that, you are free. And you say, my job is to be obedient, to do what is right, and to leave the results in God's hands. Because humanly, I will give up. Humanly, I will be crushed. This is a level of evil that no one has ever taken on. I'm not just talking about the moneyed interests who wanted to have him killed and, you know, on and on and on. But I mean, this is really dark stuff. And I think the key is understanding that what made him keep going is he realized this is God's battle. I am an instrument in his hands. I will never give up because I'm just going to do what he asked me to do. He didn't say to me, you win, you figure it out. He did try to figure it out and ultimately did win. But there's a kind of a humility and a freedom that comes with knowing on my own, I don't think I could do this. I'll get burnt out. I'll get crushed. Some people did.
Welcome to the award-winning Leadership in the Environment podcast. We guide you to living better by your values. We bring you relevant views on important topics without doom and gloom. We focus on awareness and action. It's about bringing fun, community, and connection to your everyday life. If you're new to the channel, please consider subscribing and turning on notifications. Let's do this. I'll describe how I learned about Eric Metaxas and had to have him on the show. And in the process, I think you'll learn a bit about Eric himself. You can hear it start in my conversation with Maya Rosen. I'm saying her name wrong. It's properly said in Swedish. But she told me about a book about British abolitionists in the late 1700s and early 1800s called Bury the Chains, which brought me to podcast guest Adam Hochschild. He and I have mutual friends, it turns out. Learning about that movement led me to learn about William Wilberforce, Thomas Clarkson, John Newton, and their peers. These are people I'd never heard of before a few months ago. I looked them all up, watched tons of videos on them, which I highly recommend, and found I was just full of inspiration by these people. Usually inspiration means inspired by people and their achievements, which applies in this situation. But in this case, I was also inspired by looking at the world in a new way. In this case, I saw for the first time a deep misunderstanding. I saw in how I, and as far as I can tell, nearly everyone sees identifying the problem with pollution. We present ourselves as the ones who will suffer. We say, if we don't fix this, then our children are going to suffer. We're going to suffer. There's going to be rising sea levels and things like that. We may suffer personally, but the problem is already now. The abolitionists saw suffering elsewhere. That is, they were in England and they saw suffering in the Caribbean, in Jamaica, on the plantations for sugar and molasses and rum. They identified that their community, the people around them, thousands of miles from where the suffering was, that they contributed to it and benefited from it. When they saw that they were benefiting from other people's suffering, they said, even though I could benefit, just like everyone around me is, now that I know the suffering that I'm contributing to, I cannot accept that benefit. On the contrary, I must make my life's mission to end that suffering. A small number of people in England decided they were going to take it upon themselves to end slavery. First, the slavery trade, and then slavery. It took them 20 years of work to end the slave trade, and then another 25 years after that to end slavery, at least to make it illegal. Enforcing it was another story, but that was the first step. Nearly no one around them could accept it. Their economy depended on slavery. Every excuse you can think of to indulge in polluting behavior today that you think of as, well, what I do doesn't matter, and if we don't do it, then China will or Russia will. All that applied there, more so. Anybody would have said one person can't make a difference. Individual actions were worthless. Yet a few individuals acted and transformed the world. They transformed themselves first. Eric Metaxas wrote a book on William Wilberforce that explored his personal struggles, triumphs arising from his faith in Jesus, and revealed what it takes to take on the most powerful industries in the world for decades, and then to win. The book is a companion to a movie. Both of them are named Amazing Grace. Wilberforce's friend and mentor, John Newton, wrote the hymn Amazing Grace. That's where it came from. After years of people saying, Josh, why are you so extreme about this? There's no point in not flying. Just get with the program. Just have a good time. Get some takeout. Or they would say, what I do doesn't matter. I can't do anything. I can't change. Finally, I found a role model, a companion, someone telling me across history that I'm on the right track, that this can be done. If you look Eric up, you'll find that he's a writer, but he never meant to write a biography before the biography on Wilberforce, but got caught up in Wilberforce. Then about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, which, sorry, I won't get in this introduction to talk about how much Bonhoeffer means to me, but you'll hear my conversation with Eric about the meaning that Bonhoeffer has brought to me and my family. Back to Eric, he loved the subject of Wilberforce so much that he went for it and did that biography and wrote others and became a New York Times bestselling author. I believe he wrote it to inspire people like me, which it did. I had to learn more. He's also the host of the Eric Metaxas radio show, which is very popular. And my few evangelical friends told me how Wilberforce and Bonhoeffer tower in their worlds. I should mention that I learned that despite what looked like a struggle for the abolitionists, pushing up against the greatest, most powerful industries in the world's largest empire, I believe that they loved what they did, that what they did brought them more meaning and purpose than anyone doing almost anything I can think of today. Many today will say that Wilberforce changed the world as much as anyone ever. After booking Eric, I researched his radio show more, which I hadn't looked into. I just knew that he did it. I found hardcore support for Trump, whose environmental policy, any way I can see it, conflicts heavily with stewardship and sustainability. I just can't see Donald Trump making the world more sustainable. Nonetheless, there seem many places of agreement that Eric and I think have in terms of values and faith and where our actions are coming from. We didn't get to talk politics. We only had 30 minutes and we talked about plenty of amazing stuff, but I value bringing people with diverse viewpoints and exploring them on the show. I could go on with this introduction, but I hope this is the first of many conversations with Eric. I researched his material and saw nearly nothing on the environment or sustainability, only a bit on climate, but not on plastics, pollutions, or what I think of when I look across oceans to where we cause suffering to those helpless to stop us, dumping our waste, digging for oil and resources. And I imagine that William Wilberforce looked across oceans in the same way and saw suffering that his community caused, and he acted, and I'm acting too. Most who know me know I rarely talk religion. While it's not my starting point on the environment, the more I talk to people for whom religion motivates them, the more commonality I find in the feelings of inspiration and the language that we use of faith and joy and hope and getting to act, not having to, of finding a joy in helping those helpless, thinking about them more than we think about ourselves. Here's Eric. Welcome to the Leadership in the Environment podcast. This is Joshua Spodek. I'm here with Eric Metaxas. Eric, how are you?
I'm thrilled to be here. I've been really looking forward to this, so I am great. Thank you.
I have to be careful not to gush, but your work has changed so much for me in such a short period of time. If it's okay, I've tried to structure this so that most of my episodes are longer than half an hour, and I want to get some really core stuff in.
Well, we can do this again when somebody gushes like that. You know, I'm in for 5 hours. Really, I'm honored that you would say that because that's my instinct is to gush about what I've read about you. So I feel really honored that anything I've done would have been acknowledged by you, much less might have touched you or helped you think things through. So yeah, whatever you want to talk about in the time we have will be fun. And if we run out of time, happy to come on back.
Okay. I'll start with some personal stuff about what was going on in my life when I discovered, it started with William Wilberforce, but then also Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Yeah.
In ways that I really had never heard the names before. So I read Amazing Grace. And then I'm only up to about 1933 in Dietrich Bonhoeffer's, in the book on Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Yeah.
So I'll say why each of them is so important to me and how your stuff has changed so much for me. One of the big things is that some time ago, I started acting, the way I think of it is taking responsibility for how my behavior affected others through the environment. There's a lot of pollution. There's people dying all over the world.
Yeah.
And a lot of people talk to me and they say, Josh, why are you so extreme about it? Why do you make such a big deal about it? Why don't you just get with the program? Just be like everyone else. And I always felt like there was people suffering and that was a real problem for me.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I saw the perspective of people in England seeing just, you know, I can just buy the sugar and the molasses, no problem. The empire is strong. If we don't do it, the French will, trade slaves and so forth. And suddenly the perspective of William Wilberforce, Thomas Clarkson, John Newton, it really resonated with me.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people don't follow what you're saying totally because you've read the book. But I mean, the point is that today, everybody knows, oh, slavery is wrong. Everybody knows the slave trade was evil. Everybody knows racism is wrong. Well, don't be so arrogant, because not that long ago, most people didn't think it was wrong. Most people had a totally different perspective. And I think it needs to humble us and to say, not just about the environment, but about a lot of stuff, like maybe I'm missing some stuff here, because there's some figures in history that were totally swimming upstream. Everybody thought they were nuts to even propose the idea of ending the slave trade, because you said it was like, buoying the economy, and like, are you crazy? And it's existed since the beginning of time. So why are you so hopped up on this? So yeah, it takes a lot to see what we don't want to see. So anyway, I don't mean to annotate so quickly, but go ahead.
Not at all. And I'll put in a plug here, because you probably are too humble to, but the first couple pages of your book talk about how the slave trade was what you said. It's been there forever.
Yeah.
What's the problem? And to realize the scope and magnitude of what these few people were up against was just unimaginable. It's unimaginable, except there are things like that today.
I guess that's the issue, is that the story of Bonhoeffer and the story of Wilberforce for me, and I think, I want to be clear, these were men of profound Christian faith. These were not churchgoers. They were not, Bonhoeffer was not a Gentile. He was a Christian. There's a big difference, because a lot of times people think like, you're either a Jew or a Gentile. Well, yeah, that's true. But there are plenty of Gentiles that are not Christians. This was a guy, and the same with Wilberforce, who, because they were those rare figures who really took their faith seriously, it compelled them to do things and to see things that your average churchgoer who really was not even on board. For a lot of people, faith is a cultural thing, which is to say it's not really much of anything. Like, they're kind of going where the wind blows. And these were two people that they took a lot of criticism for doing what today we applaud. We all applaud, Bonhoeffer stood up against Hitler. He stood up for the Jews. Of course. No, of course. Most of us would not have been where he was. And that's really humbling.
Yeah. And there's so many directions I want to go in. I'm going to jump to what I hope to get to at the end about Bonhoeffer. And this part I haven't reached in the book yet. I know that at some point he's already been to New York and back in the part that I've read.
Yeah.
He's not yet come to New York and back again. And there's something very personal for me, that my mother grew up Lutheran on a small farm and then in a small town in South Dakota. And before I was born, she converted to Judaism. And I never understood why. And she had always said something about, because if the Holocaust were to happen again, mm-hmm. it was something about playing her cards. She wanted, not her words, but she wanted to make sure that she would do the right thing, that she wanted to. And I'm really looking forward to what must have been in a struggle for him to come back, to say, I cannot be a part of Germany in the future if I'm not part of Germany now. And
it's huge. Yeah.
And I was just talking to my mom about that last night. I asked her, she knew about Bonhoeffer long before I ever did. And she says it didn't really factor into, but there's something there that I'm now connecting with her on something, and she's realizing something about herself that's another place that's very personal for me that I totally didn't expect.
Bonhoeffer is an anomaly. I mean, he's very hard to, there's certain figures in history that, on the one hand, they're, sui generis. They just come out of nowhere and boom, there they are. And at the same time, Bonhoeffer is that, because he's this ultimate link between Christians and Jews in a way that, I can't think of anybody who is a bridge between Jews and Christians in the way that Bonhoeffer was. But at the same time, as much of a genius as he was, as much of a prophetic figure and courageous champion that he was, he also standing on the shoulders of giants, in the sense that his family, and that's why I go into that in the beginning of the book, which you've read, but I mean, his family was an amazing family. Mm-hmm. Some people have that, where you grow up in an environment that is just, it tees you up. I didn't, I gather you didn't. It's kind of a weird thing. Some people, they just grow up in this perfect, amazing environment of these geniuses and well-connected people and stuff. And yet, he alone in his family took this path. I mean, the rest of his family were scientists and either atheists, agnostics, or whatever. But for some reason, he chooses this wild path. It was not popular. They were like his brothers and sisters were kind of making fun of him. Like, you're this super genius. And like, you're going to go study theology, or you're going to become a pastor. Like, you're out of your skull. You're wasting your mind. But you know, I don't want to give it away, but he was such an amazing figure. And it struck me when I was writing my book, it's been 10 years. The book, there's a new 10th anniversary edition. Today I'm going to go downtown here in New York and record the introductory essay. I wrote a long essay for this new edition. But the fact is that I realized when I was thinking about writing this book, you know, 13 years ago, there wasn't a book that I could hand to people and say, you want to know who Bonhoeffer is, here, read this book. There were like scholarly tomes that most people wouldn't read. And I thought there's a character here that is so real and so approachable. You read it in his diaries and in his letters to his friends and whatever, but that weren't really published. I mean, you know, his theology is hard to read. But when you realize that he combined this genius level of theology and academic work with talking to the person in the pew, teaching children, you start realizing that's a very rare figure who can work on both those levels. And that's why I think he's so lovable and beautiful, you know, anyway, yeah.
And now I jumped ahead because I was just talking to my mom about it last night. One of the things I really wanted to learn about, and I also have to mention that the people in my life that were getting closer to me in this, I mean, a lot of people are like, we don't understand why you're so into this. And to me, it's a matter of responsibility. It's a matter of doing unto others. And because I'm really thinking about the people on the other side of it. It's not an abstract environment. It's the people have to breathe the air. The people have to, you know, the mercury gets into their blood systems and it's into our own. But it's really the others that are feeling it. Okay, so Wilberforce, here's one that really, I wonder if you have insight into this. He, 20 years, he's proposing bills into the parliament. And even after that, there's still more decades to come. 1 year into it, 5 years into it, 10 years into it, 20 years into it. What's going on inside of him? How is he losing it? Does he feel bad? I mean, obviously there's going to be ups and downs and things, but
I think this is the key to the whole thing. And this is unavoidable. Wilberforce, like many people, he was a good guy, right? But at age 25, kind of happened to Bonhoeffer in a way, around in his mid-20s, he had one of those experiences, which is not always fun. I had it around my 25th birthday, where you're thinking, is this God thing real? Because culturally, we look down on people who take the Bible that seriously or whatever, and I don't know, and it. But something happened in his life where he understood, I was put on this planet for God's purposes. Now, people can read that how they want. But the point is, he said, taking on the slave trade, no human being is capable of ending the slave trade in the British Empire. This is like a divine calling. Anybody knows it's insane to say, this thing that has existed since the beginning of time wasn't invented by some white people in 1619, as some, you know, fake historians would have you think. No, since the beginning of time, human beings have abused other human beings horribly and often through pure slavery. And Wilberforce was fighting a worldview that said, this is as normal as anything. You might not like it, but there's no world where this doesn't exist. So when he had this experience with God, he realized, okay, I want God to use me to end this evil. And he knew what many, this is the same thing with Bonhoeffer. Both of them had the privilege and the horror of seeing the evilness of evil. Most people in England had no clue of how truly evil the slave trade was. Wilberforce was able to see, because he met people and he knew people like John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace, who gave him testimony. And when you see it, you can never unsee it. And the same thing with Bonhoeffer. He had this privilege of being in this high German family that had many connections with Jews. He knew what was happening when your average German could never have seen this until everybody saw it. But the point is that once you see that, you say, now what do I do? The difference between Wilberforce and most of the people around him is that he prayed, and at some point I think 2 years after this dramatic conversion, he writes in his diary, what I say are 20 famous words. He writes, God Almighty has set before me two great objects. Number one, the suppression of the slave trade. And number two, what he called the reformation of manners. He meant the reformation of culture. In other words, he says, God Almighty has set before me. I didn't choose them. So if God chose me to take this on, it's not my battle. You know, just as you read in the Pentateuch, you know, the battle belongs to the Lord. You can't win this on your own. So once you realize that, you are free and you say, my job is to be obedient, to do what is right, and to leave the results in God's hands, because humanly, I will give up. Humanly, I will be crushed. This is a level of evil that no one has ever taken on. And we're not, I'm not just talking about the moneyed interests who wanted to have him killed and, you know, on and on and on. But I mean, this is really dark stuff. And I think the key is understanding that what made him keep going is he realized this is God's battle. I am an instrument in his hands, and I will never give up because I'm just going to do what he asked me to do. He didn't say to me, you win, you figure it out. Of course, he did try to figure it out and ultimately did win. But there's a kind of a humility and a freedom that comes with knowing on my own, I don't think I could do this. I'll get burnt out. I'll get crushed. Some people did, you know, they just kind of walked away after 12 years of bitter defeats or whatever it is. You just say, I give up. I got to spend time with my family. I can't handle it. Wilberforce was he had all kinds of illnesses. He had all kinds of problems. He kept going, and he makes it clear that that's why, that it wasn't on his own strength. And I think the same thing with Bonhoeffer. You know, you cannot possibly rationally take this on unless you really do know this is the right thing. And there is such a thing as the right thing. It's not my point of view. This is right on a deep universal level. And it kind of changes your approach. It makes it less about, I got to do this, white knuckle it, then I'm an instrument. And I think that that's why they're such heroes, because it takes, that takes real humility.
Yeah, the word humility, you said it a couple of times, is what it seems like to take on one of the strongest parts of the empire would seem to take hubris. It would seem to be like, who do you think you are? Because when I first realized that there was something missing on how people were approaching the environment, I felt like there's no Mandela of the environment. There's no Dr. King of the environment. And at first I was like, oh, well, that's interesting. And then it couldn't go away. It wouldn't go away. And I felt like if that's something missing and that's important, then, and I think I want to do something, then I should do that. And now who says that? Who says I'm going to be the Mandela of the environment? And of course, it's not exactly Mandela. It's not Dr. King exactly. They did different things.
Right.
But if I were to fail, I would imagine people would say, you idiot, what did you think? Like, why did you act that way? But if I were to succeed, I'm taking on like huge asset, you know, the biggest, one of the biggest.
Exactly.
And it's not me. There's a humility that is the opposite of what it looks like from the outside. But I'm as vain as anyone. I'm reading your works to find these men, these people, and what they struggled with, how the world looked to them. It's easy to say, as you said, oh yeah, Hitler's bad. Okay, let's go against Hitler. But I mean, I'm not at this part yet, but to conceive of not just going to war and fighting in a battle, but to say, I'm going to kill that person.
Well, I mean, that takes a lot of...
That's not where I am, by the way. I'm not thinking anything like that.
Well, no. But I mean, and it's not... I don't think it's where anybody gets, but you know, you have a unique situation. And here's the problem, you know, typically when you're dealing with somebody like a Bonhoeffer, most people overwhelmingly are not Bonhoeffer. And when he thought this through, and that's why I detail it in the book, what was his thinking? Because a lot of people really sloppily think like, oh, somebody's evil, I guess it's okay to kill him. No. Bonhoeffer, first of all, Bonhoeffer firmly believed what the Bible says about murder. Murder is wrong in every case, but the Bible allows for killing. There's war. David kills Goliath. You don't say David murdered Goliath. Like, he didn't sneak up on him and cut his throat. Even that when I speak to church groups, people don't get that. They're like, well, wait a minute, how could a man of God get involved in a plot to kill her? And you're like, wait a second. Since the beginning of time, or at least since the beginning of the church, we believed in just war. There are cases when if somebody attacks you, you have the ability to defend yourself. You're not supposed to be psyched to, you know, shoot a gun to defend yourself. You're not supposed to be psyched to have a military to defend your country, but there's a role for that. So where does that role go? How far does that go? And then when does it become taking something into your own hands? And that's what really Bonhoeffer struggled with, because he said he knew the wickedness of the Nazis in a way that I really think most Germans honestly had no clue. He had seen things because of who he was and who his family was. And then he also saw the failure of the church in Germany, which was very culturally powerful. They got this wrong in both ways, in the liberal way and in the conservative way. They both sides of the church got the whole thing wrong for different reasons. And he realized that God has deputized the church to be the conscience of the state. They're not doing that. And what is my role then? If I have this relationship with God, he calls me to do what I can do. If I failed to wake up the church, would he call me to get involved with this secular plot to go against Hitler? Now, I say secular plot, no surprise, tons of the people involved in that plot were very serious about their faith. So, but it's sort of complicated. And you watch him, and he knew he was going out on a limb, and most of his friends or people would look at him like, what are you doing? Like, are you crazy? You're getting in bed with that group of people. You're going to get your hands dirty that way. What is wrong with you? And so it was a lonely road for him. But what I say and what Bonhoeffer says is that, you know, you're playing to an audience of one. God is your judge. It's not those people. And you have to really be clear in your heart. Is God calling me to do this? And if I think he is, then I will do it. And I'm willing to take the slings and arrows of people who don't get that and who condemn me. And at the same time, Bonhoeffer, which I find so cool, is that he said, but I know that God is a gracious God. And that even if I get this wrong, he's looking at my heart. He's not going to be like, oh, you got it wrong. You screwed up. That to me is a real view of the God of the Bible, a God who calls us to act, but who is also full of grace and forgiveness if we screw up. And a lot of people in the church, they weren't there. And it is really, I mean, it is an amazing story just because, you know, when you're talking about somebody like Hitler, there's no, despite what some people would think, there's no Hitler 2.0. Like, we're talking about a really rare, insane, sick, evil moment in history. And for him to do what he did and to have the courage, intellectual clarity and courage to follow what he thought was the right thing. There's a reason that his story is so fascinating, because there are very few people who would do such a thing, much less a man of God who was really serious about that. You know, he wasn't just technically, I'm a priest or I'm a pastor in a Lutheran church. No, he was all in. So it makes it, you know, the more fascinating.
If you like the show, I recommend Acting, as my guests do. It works best with someone supportive, your spouse, parents, kids, neighbors, or friends. Learn the four-step process I do with my guests and describe in my TEDx talks and do it together. You'll find yourself acting on something you care about, something meaningful. Whether you start big or small doesn't matter. If you care, if it's meaningful, you'll keep doing it. You'll reach big. Eventually, stewardship will feel normal. You'll wish you had started earlier. Second, I recommend donating to help this podcast at joshuaspodek.com/donate. I promote degrowth and stewardship, which no advertiser will touch, but brings joy, community, connection, and abundance to you when you act, and global change in the long run. Help us keep going. That's joshuaspodek.com/donate. Incredibly timeless, incredibly personal. I'm reading it in you that this is not like, you're not just, oh, here's a book I wrote. I thought it would sell a few copies. And I understood it. Actually, I was reading about how you switched publishers, and then
it was hell. It was pure hell. I've never been through anything like it in my life. And I don't want to go through anything like it again, ever. It was really unpleasant. But, you know, I will say it for myself, because I live the same way as I'm able to. I feel like God called me to write it. And if it weren't for that, you better believe I would have given up, because it was really unpleasant. And I was sure it would not sell a lot of copies. I mean, 600-page book on a German theologian, it's not going to sell a lot of copies. Everybody knows that, right? Well, sometimes God knows stuff we don't know, but it was really, it was painful. I wrote a book called Miracles. And in my Miracles book, I tell the story of what happened in terms of writing the Bonhoeffer book. But it really was, it's just one of those moments. The book changed my life, but I never dreamt it would. I just thought I want to get it done and move on to the next book.
I'm sitting down. I have two books out and I'm working on my third, and everything changed. I mean, that's when I talk about everything changing, of the perspective of, for one thing, role models, people in history who've done things like what needs to be done, because so many people right now are living, what can I do? What one person does doesn't matter. Governments, corporations, they're the ones who have to do it. But me, what can I do? And to hear someone, anything where something ends with, what I do doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I mean, the depth of that statement is not like a casual one-off.
No, it's dark. It's actually, you know, it partakes of evil. It's kind of like saying, like, let everything go to hell and I'm just going to float along with the tide. I think for me, you know, faith became a big part of my life. And I realized that if you are serious about God's purposes in life, about doing his will, helping the poor, doing what is right when everybody else says it's wrong or whatever, like, that's really serious. And to take the cynical view, like, you know what, it doesn't matter. Who cares? It's all going to hell anyway. I mean, I've heard a lot of so-called Christians, you know, kind of take that hopeless view, the way everything's going. And I think, wait a minute, that is, I'll use an old-fashioned word, that is sin. That is wrong. You cannot take that attitude. If you take that attitude, your whole worldview is messed up. You know, my attitude is we're supposed to fight for what is right. And again, I put the results in God's hands. I cannot change the world, but I can do what I know is right. I can do my part to the best of my ability. And sometimes it means doing things or saying things that are going to be really, really unpopular. Maybe no one will ever agree with you. Maybe some people agree with you years later. And we have to risk that. We have to do the best we can do. And I would say, I have said many, many times that that's why I don't think there's any substitute for a personal relationship with God. But a lot of people, that's like a long way to go before they can even think of such a thing. It's you know, but I have come to that because I feel like on my own, you could be the smartest person in the world and this stuff is too big. This requires wisdom and things that, you know, the highest IQ cannot really solve. So it is, we're talking about ultimate things here, Josh, right? we're talking about some big stuff, right?
It's also a great way to live. I mean, the words virtue, faith, and freedom, I see in your stuff a lot. And this is why I have to respect your time. And I know that you have something coming up right now, but I knew that this would just be the beginning of, it would be painful to wherever we could talk for 5 hours. I'm sure that after 5 hours, I'll be like, I still more like, I'm now just getting the idea of what to talk to them about.
Hey, some things are worth the time. I told you before, like I feel honored to have this conversation. So I'd love to continue it as soon as possible. We can work that out. You know, if you've got the time, I'll make the time. So whatever, this is important stuff.
Yeah. I really appreciate your time right now, the attention and everything you've given into your work so far. I'm only 1933, but I'm maybe a third of the way through the second book. And I've read a bunch of the stuff online too, and I'm looking forward to following this up. Eric Metaxas, thank you very much.
Thank you. God bless you.
I went into so much depth in the introduction, I'll try to keep it brief now. My main point is that the more we find relevant role models, the more we will act. Now, today, I think most people's role models are someone at Starbucks or the Piggly Wiggly hands you a plastic cup or a bag, and you think, oh, I shouldn't take this. It's probably going to pollute. And you look around and everyone else is using them. So you figure, well, everyone else is, I guess it's okay. In other words, our role models are everyone else. In other words, we follow like we're sleepwalking. Wilberforce and Bonhoeffer acted. Along with their peers, it wasn't just them. It's why we make movies like Schindler's List or Amazing Grace. Do I want to be like Schindler, Wilberforce, Bonhoeffer, or like the tens of millions who sleepwalked around them saying, don't you know only governments and corporations can make a difference? Individual action will never amount to anything. One day soon, we will look back at all of our packaging the way we now look back at asbestos or leaded gasoline. We just don't accept it anymore. Yes, it has some benefit, but it's not worth it. And flying when and where we want, not thinking of the pollution coming out the back and the 80% of the world who will never fly and can never fly, suffering more from the pollution. We will look at that like we look at smoking today in a hospital or school. When I was a kid in high school, my principal smoked a tobacco pipe all the time in school. I don't think you could do that today. That change can happen. And when that change comes, it will come from a small number of people, people like those that Eric profiles. How many people are bringing a message of joy from what everyone calls saving the environment, but I call the future? Step by step, this podcast is creating a culture of joy, community, and connection around sharing and acting on our environmental values. Again, there's no profit in buying and wasting less, but we'll all love our lives and relationships more when we do. I can use your support. Please donate at joshuaspodek.com/donate. Again, that's joshuaspodek.com/donate.